With that, it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker tonight. Actually, I met Bill. I don't remember if it was at this meeting or some of the other meetings we went to a lot in common about 17 years ago, but Bill and I got to know each other attending meetings, and certainly the Summer of Prosperity Speakers was one of them. And so it's with my great pleasure that I introduce my friend Bill.
Thank you. My name's Bill, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Bill.
Hi, Bill.
This is my first time on a Zoom meeting. I've been to plenty of other regular meetings through the years. My sobriety date is April 26, 1997. And I'd just like to say I'd like to thank Bill for asking me to come and lead this meeting. When I first got sober, they told me that in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, anytime anybody asks you to do something, you need to do it. You need to do it and be grateful that they asked you to do it. You may not know the reason why, but I've always tried to do that. And because of that, that's helped me in my sobriety through the years. So thank you, Bill, for asking me to do this. And I see some familiar faces here, too. I see Dave and Matt, and I see Debbie G online. And Debbie, take care of, make sure the dog's comfortable there on the couch, too. And Sarah, and I'll do my best to try to relay what I've learned in my sobriety. And when I first got sober, I was just so glad that I didn't want to drink. That I wanted to relay everything that I did and everything, all the bad stuff that I did. And I just thought nobody had done anything like I had. I'd been the worst drinker and the most problem guy and everything there was. And then, and I couldn't wait to tell all my drunken stories every time I ever got asked to talk. And, and the longer I was sober, the more I got tired of hearing my stuff, and there was a time that I got to where in my sobriety that I prefer to talk about, the better things in my life since I became sober. And through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the people in the fellowship, I was able to improve my life and to stay sober and to be, fairly in my right mind while doing it. So, it wasn't anything I did by myself. It wasn't anything I learned by myself. I just came to AA and basically did what they told me to do, and things started getting better. So, my drinking story probably wasn't much different than anybody else's. I started drinking as a young guy, and I drank for a long time. I drank for maybe 28 years. I don't remember when I first started. Guys say, well, my dad gave me a drink of his beer. I don't remember any of that. But I remember when I was in high school and I first started, the first time I drank, I really enjoyed doing it, I probably drank alcoholically from the beginning. I'm pretty sure I did. At the time I didn't realize that. At the time I thought I was just like everybody else. But, as I was, I was a young guy, and still in high school, or maybe just barely out of high school, I could go to parties and go out and drink, and I could drink more than guys that were a lot older than me, and I could drink more and rarely got sick and could stay out a lot longer, and I thought I had a real gift. I thought that I had a real gift because I could do that. And of course, that all turned on me as I got older, because that became worse. The drinking got worse, and I started having more trouble and less fun, as they call it. But, my drinking, I never got in trouble with the law. God knows I should have been. The Tulare PD and the CHP should have had me 5,000 times because of there, especially there towards the end of my drinking, I was just drunk all the time. It wasn't like I went out and started drinking and drove around. I was drunk everywhere I went. I woke up in the morning drunk. So I would get up and drink all night, half the night. And then, it wasn't always like that. I got married in my life. I entered the family business, and I always worked. And even when I was a young guy in school, I worked after school, and because I wanted things. I wanted to be able to afford things. I wanted to have a car and be able to have some money in my pocket. And so the only alternative I had was to go to school and then work after school on weekends, and I did all those things. So, I thought I was always fairly responsible. I ended up getting married, and I had a couple of sons. And, you know, I was in the family business, and, you know, I paid my bills and mowed my lawn and all the things that, that I thought, you know, and along with that, I drink. I don't have an NA side of my story. I didn't care for the drugs, and, you know, maybe when I was younger, when I was in high school and out, you know, I smoked a little pot here and there, but I didn't really care for that. Drinking, that's what I like to do. And so therefore, that's what I do. And I had a lot of friends that did the other things, and I didn't really care to do that, and I never really had an issue with not doing that, because I drink enough to be able to fit in anywhere I went. You know, my parents, my mom and my dad did not have an alcohol problem. But deep in my family, both sides of my family, you know, both of my grandfathers were drunks. They both died drunk. My dad's dad, he was a full-blooded Cherokee Indian. He ran off and left my dad and his family when my dad was a little kid, and my dad never knew him. And then back in the 1980 or something like that, they had contacted my dad and said that they had found his father, and he lived over in Fallon, Nevada in an old, you know, care home over there, and he was on welfare, and every time he'd get his check, he'd spend it all on booze for him and his buddies, and he passed away, he died over there, and they told my dad, says, well, I never knew my dad, how'd you know it was me? And so they gave him the information and said, you know, had his couple of brothers and a sister, and said, well, you know, however they found out, they said, you need to come over here and get your father and make some funeral arrangements for him, and he owes us some money. And, you know, my dad had never known him, so my dad and his two sisters, they went up there and they made funeral arrangements and they paid his bills and, you know, buried him, and that was the end of that. So I had an uncle. I was named after my Uncle Bill, and I never knew my Uncle Bill. All I knew is when I was young, Uncle Bill had died, and he'd never talked about it. Later on in life, I find out that my Uncle Bill was a drunk. My Uncle Bill was, and I was named after him, so little did anybody know that they got that part of it right. And he was drunk and he gambled and bet on horses, and I guess, you know, it's a lot of gambling debts to some bad people, and they found him one morning rolled up in a carpet in the front yard. So, you know, that was the legacy of my name coming from my Uncle Bill. And so I have that deep in both. On my mom's side of the family, her, my other grandfather, he died drunk. And I had an uncle and a couple of cousins that did get drunk and fight and tear up the house and stab each other and go to jail and all this stuff, you know. So I have it in my family. And why I have it, other members of my family have it, I don't know. I found early that acceptance is you know, the key to my staying sober, is to accept the fact, don't question why or how, just accept the fact that I am. And once I start accepting the fact that I am and other people aren't like me, then my recovery started getting a little better. But I drank. That was all after. I drank long before I knew any of those facts. And I thought I was doing okay, but as I got older, the more I drank, you know, the less fun I started having. There was a time that the first wife that I had, she decided she hadn't lived her life, and she ran off with the cowboys to go out and have a little fun in her life, and left me with my two sons to raise, and I, as a mother and a father, and I, you know, I did that. I did the best I could with them. And, you know, I raised two young men that are, they have their own families now, and they grew up, they're productive, they work, they both work, they own houses, they, you know, they provide, and I don't think it was anything that I did special for them. I just did the best I could at the time, and along with all of that, I drink, you know, because at that point, I didn't have anybody to have to answer to. I was in the family business, so I could do what I wanted to do. Nobody was going to fire me or anything. And so my drinking kind of shifted gears, and I went into a higher speed after that. And I got to find myself pretty soon. I was drinking earlier in the day, and then drinking at noontime, and then it seemed like I crossed the line. In the invisible line they talk about, when I found the morning drink, You know, I found the morning drink. I found that if I had a little shot of Jack Daniels before I went to work, that it kind of smoothed the morning out. And, you know, and then that became I'd have to go home in about a couple hours and have another one. And then it became just drinking, you know, taking it to work and hiding it and just drinking there because I didn't, you know, need to take off and be going home every hour. And over a period of a couple of years or a few years, several years, that my drinking had increased to the point to where I had crossed that line that they talk about. I had no idea what that was. And I knew I shouldn't have been doing that, but I thought it was okay. You know, and I was drinking pretty much all the time. And within a couple more years, I was drinking around the clock. And I kind of knew that I shouldn't have been doing that. Maybe I might have a problem, but I thought if things would get bad, like getting up at 5 in the morning and, you know, getting a couple of shots of Jack Daniels and throwing up in the shower, like, that's not bad enough. If things started to get bad, you know, I would quit if I had to. But at that point, I didn't really have to. So the truth was, I could not quit. I had gotten to the point to where I needed to drink to kind of halfway function, if you will. Everywhere I went, it had to be involved. I had to be involved with drinking. It had to be some drinking before, during, or after. Or I found myself not doing those things anymore. I had done a lot of things in my life. Thanks to my parents, my father, you know, as a young guy, I got to do a lot of things. You know, it wasn't like I was thrust into nothing to do in my life when I started drinking because I was bored. You know, I had motorcycles, and through the years I raced cars in various different capacities, and I learned to fly. I flew airplanes. I could hunt and fish and all those things. So I had a lot of opportunity and a lot of things in my life to have fun, and I did this thing. It got to work at that point in my life with my drinking. Once I drank, it was like they say, you don't know how much more you're going to drink and how long you're going to drink and what you're going to do, and that's exactly what it was like for me. And it got to the point to where if I couldn't do anything when I wasn't drinking involved, I wouldn't do it. And, you know, I started having people, this is after a few years of it, and, you know, my sons were older, they were in high school, and I know there was times that I had embarrassed them by my drunken actions and things that I'd done, and then again, you know, I was pretty much all they had because their mother had run off and left and had no kind of life for them. And some, you know, they didn't know what I was going to do and how I was going to be. So I know that they were pretty scared at times. Or, you know, what are we going to do if, you know, if dad, you know, kills himself in a car wreck or drinks himself to death or whatever, you know, what are we going to do? And through the years when I got sober, I was able to make amends to them, and they all stopped it off. Oh, Dad, it was nothing, you know. But they knew, and I knew that they were afraid. But I could not stop doing what I was doing. I could not stop drinking. And for those of you that know what it's like to not be able to not drink, you know how that feels. It's a horrible way to live. You know, I would get up, and if I wasn't drinking, I was thinking about drinking. And I got to where, you know, at work, I wasn't producing anything at work. I wasn't doing anything, and you know, I was ticking people off, and, you know, I even had good friends of mine, lifelong friends, who were asking me, hey, what's the matter with you, you know, what's the matter, you've been drinking a lot, I deny it, it was all denial, and they knew, and I kind of knew they knew, but I stopped it off, so the next thing I would do to fix that was I would stay away from them, so I started avoiding them. All the things that we did when we were drunk, when our drinking got bad, I did all those things. You know, I know that the reason that the slurry PD didn't do anything for some of the things I'd done, you know, and driving around and doing some of the things I'd done is because I knew most of them. They were customers of mine. Some of them were friends of mine, and they pretty much back then looked the other way. You know, if it was now, That's not going to happen now. They don't do things like that now, but they did then. And so that probably saved my ass who knows how many countless times. But anywhere else I would have gone, I could have been in big trouble. You know, I could have killed somebody, could kill myself. You know, all the things I could have done, just driving. And so at the end of my drinking became to where I became physically sick. You know, I got physically sick, and I started hallucinating a couple of different times. And you know, I got to where I couldn't work. I'd go home, and I was claiming I had the flu, and da 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 da. I just sat home and drink until I'd conk out, wake up, and drink again. It went on for days and days, and I'd go work a little bit. And it just got insane. It just got to where there was, you know, nothing I could do but that. And I worried. I would worry. I'd wake up in the middle of the night. How am I going to pay my bills? What am I going to do? You know, why? I need to stop doing this. And I wouldn't sleep. I'd be so exhausted and tired. But yet, I'd get up and I'd have another couple of shots of something, go back to bed, pass out. I'd do that nightly. And then I'd drink most of the day. I was avoiding people. I wasn't producing. I was just not functioning anymore. It was just a sorry, sorry, sad way to live. And I could not stop doing it. I was just an alcoholic. I was an alcoholic in the middle of the disease, and I had no idea what I was going to do. Well, a lady that I had been seeing, and we've been going together for a while, you know, she had put up with all of this, and she pretty much knew what was happening, and it went on and on and on, and it got to the point where I got taken to the hospital because I was bleeding to death, and I almost died in the hospital. That was kind of towards the end of my drinking. And I was in the ICU, and they did a surgery on my stomach because I was bleeding to death. And, you know, and the doctor told me, you know, if you don't quit drinking, you're going to die, and I can't fix you again. And so, you know, when I didn't die, I got to that, and I fixed that. I quit going to that doctor. You know, I found another doctor, and that doctor had saved my life. And so I got out of that time at the hospital, and I was home for a few days, and I got the feeling, and all I could do was think about, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? All I could think about was drinking. And I knew that I just, you know, almost died from that. And I hadn't drank. I just shook, and my mind was just racing. Debbie G always says she didn't have a committee in her head going off. She had a marching band, you know, and I guess I probably had that too. But, you know, I finally, after a few days home, I was feeling good enough to where I said, you know, why am I torturing myself? Why don't I just drink a little bit? You know, that wasn't so bad. I just not drink as much as I used to. I just drink a little bit, you know, just to kind of calm my nerves and smooth out. And God, within a day, I was drinking more than I was before I went to the hospital. So now I call that being powerless. I was completely powerless over alcohol. And I know that today, even these years later, I would be completely powerless if I thought I could do that. I'm an alcoholic, and I could not stop drinking. My family and friends that had enough of me at that point, and behind my back, they had arranged an intervention. And I woke up one morning, and I had been drinking, and I woke up that morning, and my house was full of people one morning at 5 o'clock in the morning. And they said, hey, I wonder, what the hell are all these people doing in my house? 5 in the morning. And they were all there. I don't have much family left, but my friends and my sons and my one cousin that I had, they were there, and they said, hey, we want to talk to you about something. And I thought, God, this has got to be about my drink. And everybody's going to bug me about my, and it was. And I was so beat, and I was so tired that I had no fight left in me. And they all went around, they told me, they read their little letters to me, and they had arranged for me to go to a place. And if I could not stop drinking on my own, I couldn't do the first thing. I couldn't put the plug in the jug. And so I said, okay, I'll go. And in my mind, I thought, you know, I'll get this fixed. So I'll go and get them off my back, and it'll look okay, and then I'll still be able to drink. That's the way I thought about everything. I'll fix this. And I usually got out of it. So I got taken down to a place, my youngest son in, and my wife now, we're married now, we weren't married then. They took me down to a place in San Clemente called Pacific Hills, and they said, you know, we're going to take you down to a place, and we're going to get you fixed, and we're going to make you feel better, and we're going to come back and it's going to be better. And when I first got down there, I was pretty physically sick again, and I was detoxing again, and they didn't want to take me because they thought I was going to die down there, and somebody would see me and go running off out of there. But they did, they let me stay, you know, they put me up in the third floor and they called it the dungeon up there and they kept me up there and I detoxed again another, I don't know, couple of days and then I woke up one morning and I had actually woke up and the windows were open, I could hear sounds outside, that was the end of April I got sent down there. This was the first end of April, 1st of May. And, you know, I hadn't heard sounds. There was a little breeze coming in. I felt pretty good. I wasn't shaking real bad. I hadn't wet the bed. You know, I could stand up and I didn't feel too bad. And so I got dressed and I went down to the kitchen area it was. And, I was making some coffee and this counselor came in. He was the counselor that I had. His name was Kelly M. Kelly, you know, he says, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I woke up, you know, and I gotta get, I was trying to get some coffee." So we made some coffee and he said, "Sit down, let's talk." Well, the first time we really got to talk and I talked and he's asking me, you know, "How much were you drinking?" And I didn't want him to know. And he goes, "You know, you can tell me, I've heard all this stuff, it's no big deal." And so I kind of got a little bit honest with him. And so this was the first time in my life that I'd honestly talked to somebody about how I couldn't quit drinking. And he just, you know, he didn't get real upset. He didn't, you know, get all offensive or, you know, try to, you know, lecture me or any of that. He just shook his head and he told me I went through that, you know. I'm like, "What?" And he says, "Yeah, I'm an alcoholic too." And I couldn't believe it. He says, "This is how it works. I know exactly how you are. I know exactly how you feel because I was there too." And so I kind of got on the same page as this guy, and I started kind of trusting him a little bit. And we got to talking about the higher power. And I told him, you know, when I was a kid, my mom used to make us go to church when I was a little kid, and I hated it, you know, but I did believe. He says, "Well, that's all you need to do. You need to believe. If you believe that there's a higher power, if you believe there's a God that created you, and, you know, in your life, then that, you don't need to know anything about the organized religion or so all you need to do is just believe that there's a God that has a plan in your life. And if you want to stop drinking and you want to get better, just ask that God to help you. He's the only one that can help you." And so I did. You know, he says, "Well," so I was going to get to go to residence that day. So he says, "You know, when you go on and get ready to go to the treatment center from the residence," he says, "you know, if you're going to get to go today," he says, "I want you to go in and maybe, you know, sit on the end of your bed there and ask that God to help you not want to drink today." And I thought, "God, this is the stupidest thing I've ever done in my life." But I did it. You know, I was willing, had just enough willing to be willing to do it. Just that tiny bit of willingness just to do. Because I thought, man, if I could just do what this guy's doing, you know, and, you know, if I could just do this and feel a little better, because I felt pretty good physically, and it's the first time in ages. And, you know, I went in and I asked God to, you know, "Please let me not drink today," or, you know, "Help me not drink today," or whatever it was. And then I, you know, I thought, "Well, I better get serious about this," you know. So I tried real hard, you know, "God, I can't, you know, stop drinking, help me." And, you know, so I got to go to the treatment center that day, and we went on, and I was thinking about, you know, how stupid this whole thing was, and how am I here, you know, why am I here, and how did I get here, what have I done to myself? But all day long, by the time I got back that afternoon late, we went through these little session meetings every hour, these little group classroom things. And I got back to the residence, and I realized that I hadn't wanted to drink. And I didn't really want to drink then. And it was the first time in years that I had not thought about wanting to drink. In fact, I didn't even want one then. Even if they could have gave me one, I didn't want one. And so that was the beginning, the very little spark in the beginning of my recovery fire right there. That was the very beginning that I realized that there might be some truth in this and there might be a little bit of chance that this might work. And so I cleaned up and we went to dinner and I met other people there and I got to be a part of the you know, the residents and the treatment center group and all that stuff. And the next morning I got up and the first thing I did was I asked God again, please help me not drink today. I can't do this. And, you know, please. So his words were, remove the desire to drink. And I said, please remove the desire to drink like you did yesterday. And I went to that treatment center again, and again that day I had not wanted to drink. And that was, I don't know, my third or fourth day there at the treatment center. That was back after April 20, that was maybe the 1st of May. So I stayed my 28 days there, and every morning I did that prayer. I asked God to help me not want to drink today, and remove that desire to drink, and then I would go to the treatment center, and then, you know, half of the stuff, every other night we got to go to an AA meeting. We got put in the vans. I called the vans, those big 10 passenger vans, I called them the joy bus, you know, and we'd get in the joy bus and they'd haul us to a meeting, and then every other night in between that was a book study. You know, they gave me a big book, and I couldn't make heads or tails of that. I was still brain stupid, but I was feeling physically pretty good, you know. And they said, well, take this yellow marker and we'll just read a page in the beginning. Just read that page, and if there's something that makes sense or something you like, just mark that with that highlighter. And then later on, if you go back in there where you see what that yellow mark is, read it again. See if it makes more sense to you. And so that was the beginning of my recovery. And that was when I started reading the big book. Sometimes it was just a page at a time, and I'd have to go read it for a couple of different times before I understood what it was saying, just in a page, you know, in the beginning of the big book. And so I stayed my time there. I did what I was told at the treatment center. My son and my wife now, they had come a couple of times on visitors' days. They could come on Sunday and I could visit, you know, we could visit. So, you know, life was getting to be a little bit better, and there was a chance that I might be at home. So I spent my 28 days there, and then they come and got me, and I went home, and I was home. And they said, you know, I remember we had to have this exiting plan. We had to write out this exiting plan before we left about what we're going to do. We had to have these trigger cards, you know, what's going to trigger you, make you want to go drink, and what's going to... I did, I had this big old BS and college thesis, I thought, you know, that I had this exiting plan, and this Kelly was looking at this in the beginning, and, you know, I mean, when I was getting ready a few days before, and he's just shaking his head, he goes, man, he wrote this stuff. And he goes, you don't need all this stuff, you don't need all this. He says, you know, you don't need to come back down here, and you don't need to go to the hospital, and you don't need a psychiatrist, and all this other stuff, you know. He says, you need to go back home, and you need to face the things you left. You need to go back to work and become productive and have your family and pay your bills and go back and, you know, and be productive again and live your life. And you need to go to a lot of meetings right now, a lot of AA meetings. So when you get back, you go to your central office or wherever you can, and you get a schedule of your local meetings, and you start circling ones, and you start going. And you need to go to a lot right now because you're pretty sick right now. So you need to go to a lot. You know, later on, you may not have to go to a meeting. Right now, you need to go to a lot. So I left, and I came home. And I, there was so many funny things that happened when I got home, just by coincidence, you know, that I remember now. And I remember there was I went to get a haircut because I hadn't had a haircut in probably a couple of months, and I was looking pretty bad. And I went to the barbershop, and the guy was asking me to go to the same place. And he'd go, man, where you been? I heard you was in the hospital and all this. And I told him, you know, I didn't know what else to say. So, but I told him, I said, I had to quit drinking, and I got sent off to a place. And they go, he goes, well, how did you quit drinking? And I said, I told him, you know, I said, well, I have to pray to God. You know, I didn't know what else to do but tell him what had happened. And they were sincerely, these three barbers in there, and this one guy was getting a haircut, and he happened to be some kind of minister, and he, you know, he heard, he was listening to this, and he got out of the chair, and he says, hey, do you mind if I pray for you? And all these barbers jumped back against the wall like they thought of something was going to be electrified or something. Put his hand on my forehead, he prayed for me, and I'm going, my God, what have I got myself into here, you know? And but those are some of the things that happened, and I just accepted that, you know. And And I got a schedule, and I started going to AA meetings. You know, I went, before I got shipped off, I had a guy, his name was George Ayres. He's passed away now, so I can say his whole name. But George was a wonderful man. He'd been sober a long time, and he operated a recovery home with there in Tulare, not a home, but he worked in a recovery field there in Tulare. And George and another guy had come to meet with me one time, and they were going to tell me that if I went to this AA meeting this Monday night, they would be there, and I would go there and I would hear something that would probably help me with my, you know, stop drinking. So, you know, I scuffed it all off. I finished drinking all day, and then I went to that place where he said, of course, some guys didn't show up. They weren't there. You know, they were going to be there waiting for me. They never showed up. So I went in there. I was drunk, and I didn't hear anything they said. It was the Monday night Serenity Seekers AA meeting. And there was probably 30 or 40 people in there, and I was drunk, you know, and everybody knew it. And I left, and I continued to drink. So after, but there was one guy, there were a couple of guys there, one guy named Greg H. And Greg H. come up and talked to me and asked me how I was doing. And he left me his phone number, and he gave me some literature, you know, like we do when we see a newcomer. And, of course, I lost all that stuff because I didn't need any of that. And when I came back, I went back to that meeting, and there was this Greg H. there, first guy there I saw, you know, and what is this guy again? You know, he's still here. And he come up and he goes, well, I knew we'd see you eventually, you know, and so we became friends. He goes, come on in and sit down. And the most amazing thing happened when I went to that first AA meeting sober was that people welcomed me. They welcomed me. They told me, man, we're glad you're here. And you know, the end of my drinking, people weren't welcoming me. They weren't telling me we're glad you're here. They were telling me we're glad you're leaving. And these people were welcoming me. And at first I thought they were just saying that, but they weren't. They go and shake your hand and say, man, I'm glad you're here. Here, have a seat, you know? And I didn't hear anything that I didn't believe from any of them. Everything that seemed like they told me was the truth. And he said, just keep coming back, you know. And so I started going to other meetings. And I started going to, I tried to go, they said, you need to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And I couldn't quite do that because I was trying to work and take care of my family and do this stuff too. But I went to as many as I could. And sometimes I tried to make up and go to like two a day, you know. And so I went to a lot of meetings and I met people. And there's still a lot of people around that I still know that I met when I first went, and they're still sober today, and they're still going to meetings, you know, maybe not as many as they used to, but, you know, we still do, because that's the part of my life that I had to do to stay sober. You know, I have to be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if I can't go to a meeting for a period of time, there's probably not a chance that I'm going to drink, but the thing is I need to go to keep my thinking straight. And by what other way can I keep my thinking straight than by sitting in a room full of normal people like you guys? You know, people are thinking the same way I do. And we look at things and we recover the same way. We have to go through the same thing. And, you know, you can't get that out on the street with people you don't know because they don't know what you're talking about. You know, I'm willing to tell anybody that I don't drink and wine. You know, I don't have a sign on my car or anything, you know, that says, hey, I'm an AA, you know, but I don't deny it, you know, and that's a person's choice for their own anonymity that they can choose themselves, and I have to learn that too, you know. You can be as anonymous as you want to. That's your own preference, your own choice. I choose to just be, you know, I'm not afraid if they knew that I'm an alcoholic, because I didn't care what they thought when I was out there tearing the place up, ripping and roaring drunk all the time. I didn't care what anybody thought then, so I don't care what they think. I just tell them I don't drink because I can't drink normal. And I've never had, you know, I came back, I didn't have my friends saying, ah, come on, let's go have a beer, you know, because my friends are glad that I don't drink, because none of my friends were like me. I was the worst one. None of my friends drank and did the things like I did. Just, you know, seemed like me. And through the years, I've lost some of my friends that never drank or did anything like me. And it seems like maybe it's so unfair that, you know, why them and not me? But that's not our choice to make. You know, and I've had We've lost a lot of my friends that I met in Alcoholics Anonymous through the years, too. I met some really wonderful people here. Most of them are all still here, but there's some that guys that I would sit and listen to, and I just couldn't believe what they were saying was the absolute truth and honesty, and they would share everything with me. And I learned from those guys, guys like Larry Duggan, Larry's not with us, Jerry Dean. You know, some of these old crusty old guys that, you know, nobody ever want to listen to, but if you listen to them, they've been through this, and their lives are great for them. They're completely happy, and I wanted to be like that. So I listened to them, and I did what they, you know, what they said. And because of that, my life's better. It wasn't anything I figured out on my own. But, you know, my best thinking got me drunk. So I came back, I added a few things to my morning. You know, my morning thing when I get up, I used to just get up and ask God to help me not drink. And there's a guy named Denny M. over in Denny Mills over in Tulare. And I asked Denny Secretary to Wednesday night meeting the Alpha Group out there on, I think it's called the Alpha Group, out there on Bardsley Road on Wednesday nights at Candlelight meeting. I said, what is this 24-hour book everybody's talking about? And he goes, oh, it's a meditation book. He says, you just read a page for that day. You just read that page and has some thoughts and stuff in there. And so then the next day, you read another page just for that day. You just read one page. And sometimes you want to jump ahead and read it, you know, a week, but you just do one day at a time. And I said, where can I get one of those? And he says, he went out to his car and he come back and he says, here, I'm going to give you mine. I go, no, I don't want mine. I don't want yours. I'll go get my own. He goes, no, I want you to have this one. And he signed that to me. And I think it was signed to me. June or something of 1997. He signed to me from him and whatever the date was. And I still open that book every morning to today. I did this morning and I will in the morning. I read that thought, that meditation and that prayer for the day. And it's unbelievably close even after all these years of how that is, what's, how it pertains to that day for today. And I've asked, you know, sometimes, and I read a page, I ask Bill sees it. And then I ask God to help me, you know, get through the day without wanting to drink like you have every day, because I can't do it myself. Not one time. I've been through a lot of things in my life since I've been sober and not wanting. I've been through, had a lot of fun. I've had a lot of sorrow. And through none of those things have I wanted to ever take a drink. And it's not because, like I said, of anything I did. It's because God's removed that desire to drink and that obsession. And I can keep my thinking halfway straight by the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the people in it that I can count on to help me every day. And because of that, I'm sober today. And I think I should probably call on a few people, and because I know people have a lot to say. Is the time okay on that?
Absolutely, sure.
You know, if there's something that anybody can get out of this that I've said, I mean, I hope you can. You know, the only reason we share is so that somebody might hear something and it might help you stay sober. Because if you're here because of a problem with alcohol, whether you think you need to be here or not, you probably do because you're here. I mean, that's what I always thought, you know. There's not any days that I just jump up and feel, you know, and say, hey, I think I'll go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and not drink anymore the rest of my life. That's not how it works, you know. We're here because we need to be here, and I need to be here. And I want to thank Bill again for asking me to do this, and thank you guys for listening to me, and I hope you get something out of what I have to say. It's the truth, and that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. So thanks for letting me share. Like I said, it's an honor to be able to, for somebody to want to listen to, you know, to share part of your life that made you better. And I hope you guys get something out of it. So we start calling on people now. I want to call the first one I want to call on is a guy I met here going to the Monday Night Men's meeting. And he usually has quite a bit to say, and he's been through a few things, and that's Dave. Would you like to share, Dave, for a minute?
David, I'm calling. Thank you, Dave.
Hi, Dave.
Thank you for your share. You know, I don't know that I've heard as thorough a share from you before, and I found so many similarities in your share. The one that struck me the most was that, you know, the inability to quit drinking. I had that idea, that self-reliance that, well, if alcohol becomes a problem, I'll just quit. And by 2015, it became time for me to just quit. And what I found out was over and over and over again, I could not remain quit. I didn't go through a rehab like you did. But I did go through a detox place. But then, your experience in the rehab was that, you had that counselor who asked you to just ask God for help. And, I was in an IOP, intensive outpatient, but that is where I heard that I needed to be on it for help. And like yourself, it worked. It worked, and I am thankful. And every morning I do a routine. And upon awakening, I pray, and my prayer leads with thank you, God, for another day sober. Because I was unable to do it myself, and I think that by starting that day with gratitude, that the obsession was lifted. I was hopeless before I learned that, and I remember to be grateful every morning and thanking God, and I usually follow it up with the third step prayer. I want to be of service. And, my life is so much better now. And I'm thankful for that. Thanks for calling on me, Bill.
Thanks for sharing, Dave. I appreciate that. And that's how I start my day every day, too. I would like to also call on Debbie G. Are you still there?
She just needs to unmute herself.
Oh, you need to turn your sound on.
My sound is on?
There you go. Usually we tell you to turn your sound off, but this time...
I know.
Thank you, Debbie. I saw Debbie when she first came in and watched her go through the programs.
Yes. Thank you for calling on me, Bill, and it's always a joy to hear you talk and share, and I just couldn't believe all the things about your story that were just kind of like mine, but a little bit like a man drunk. I guess I was more like a girl drunk, but I did like my Jack Daniels. That was my drinking choice too, and I didn't get in here any too soon. I drank for a long, long time, and I wrecked my life. I wrecked a lot of lives through my drinking, and I didn't start out drinking young, though. I wasn't like a teenage drinker or anything like that. You know, it was just always my behavior was just off, you know, and I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that this is a hereditary disease, and that kind of made sense to me in a whole lot of ways because, you know what, on both sides of my gene pool, alcoholism ran through and through, and it never skipped a beat, you know, and didn't skip it in my family either. Unfortunately, alcohol is not being our friend. I didn't start drinking at a young age. I was pretty much into my late 20s, but my behavior was always off. You know, my thinking was always off. I got married when I was 16. I had two babies by the time I was 19. Started a career path when I was 23, was getting a divorce at 27, and it just started ripping through there. No matter who was in the way or what my responsibility was, I would always be responsible. I always worked. I had a job. I could make a living. I just couldn't make a life. You know, that's all there was to it. And, you know, my sober date is April 16th, 2008, and I did not pick that. And I have to honestly say that is the day that I realized there was a God that was looking out after me. And I got on the internet and looked for a place to go and went to Laguna Beach. That was another thing we, some of us had in common, to go to the rehab down there. And I stayed down there for 30 days. And, you know, I was a mess. I didn't even get cleaned up or take a shower for about 4 days. And when I finally came out that evening for dinner, the guy that was in charge, he goes, "Are you new here?" And I said, "No, this it's me, Debbie." He goes, "Oh, my God." But I was beat up emotionally, you know, and spiritually bankrupt, as they say. And I don't know, that was the best thing I ever did. That's the best $10,000 I've ever spent, you know, honestly. The foundation of AA was laid to me there. And when I got back, I fortunately had a daughter that was here before me, and she was secretarying the Thursday night meeting. And she said, "Mom, you need to come to this meeting. You're going to meet so many nice ladies and these women that you're going to love them. They're just like you. You're going to have so much fun. They like to, they dress nice and they have cute purses." And she was just always going on about the women. And, you know, she was right. And my sponsor, I had met that night, but I didn't cling onto her or grab onto her or choose her as my sponsor at that time. But she became my sponsor, and I've had her now for, oh my gosh, I don't even know how long, but it's been a long time of my sobriety. You know, if you do the steps and you go through the book the way it's laid out and follow that agenda, with the best of your ability and to your best honesty, you're going to get well. And it was amazing how it worked. And then, you know, it's not magic. So if you can't be honest with yourself and with another human being, it's probably not going to turn out to be so great. But it taught me how to do that and how to put my trust in something other than myself, because I never thought I needed anybody or anything, you know. It was all about me. Didn't matter who it was. And I had 4 years of what I call sobriety one time, because what was to be husband number four bet me $1,000 I couldn't stay not drinking for a year. And I took the bet and I won the money. And then I stayed dry for 3 more years. So I had 4 years where I just didn't drink. I changed my whole life. I quit smoking. I quit drinking. I didn't even eat hamburger. I mean, I went on a health kick. I changed careers. I got my real estate license. I landed the best job I ever had. And guess what? He left anyway. I cannot run myself on self-will run riot. If I do, I'll run everybody in my life away. And that's exactly what happened. And it's not about just not drinking. This is a thinking thing for me. And I have got to make sure that I don't ever forget where I came from or who's the blesser. Because without God in my life, I'm going to be just worse than a drunk. So, if you're here and you're new, stay in, get a sponsor, go to meetings, and don't forget your God, because that's where it lies for me. Anyway, Bill, I love your story. Thank you. Thank you for sharing your April birthday with me, too. We're April babies. Nice to see you.
Thank you, Debbie. I appreciate you talking.
Thank you.
I met Debbie when I was at the Blue Room. At this meeting, used to be at the Blue Room, down in the basement at Queen Delta Hospital. My secretary at this meeting for about 2 years, and that was when it was downstairs at the hospital. It's been moved around quite a few times, and it's changed a little bit. But, you know, we met Debbie there, and when she first came in, we had bets that she was never going to see her again. Here it is, almost 14 years later, and you're still showing up.
I'm still here, man.
You're awesome. Still winning bets.
Anyway, you know what? I love you guys, and you know what? I like the camaraderie of all of the friends, I don't know what to call it. It's just joking around, having a good time, not taking ourselves so seriously.
Yeah.
You know, really.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Matt, you want to talk, Matt?
Hi, everybody. My name's Matt. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Matt.
Good to see you here. Boy, thanks for your story, Bill. I've heard it a few times, but what I get from your story is be in it for the long haul. This is not an overnight deal. The process of turning my will and my life over to the care of God as I expand Him, that really hooked me. Steps 3 and 11, what I heard in the italics, little tilty letters, to say, as I understood Him, that means that applies to me as Matt understands God. And I realized, oh boy, I didn't have a very deep understanding of God. And at the outset, who could legitimately hope to have a deep understanding of God himself, right? His ways are higher than mine, his thinking is higher than mine. And his logic, his plan is better than mine. Let's go there immediately. But I felt like, yes, this alcoholic brain will do. I need to hedge my bet. I need to get a little bit of understanding about God. This way I might get a foothold and I might be able to stay sober and drink at the same time. I might be able to do this my way. I might be able to add the parts that I like and take out the parts that I don't like. Like I dreaded step 4. Oh, no. Oh, even the more dreaded step 5. Oh, no. And I thought maybe I could just build and choose as well. That didn't work. I was able to do that for about 9 months, some years ago. And all that did was start the process by which I just came right back to the program. And looked through a stint in the hospital and another visit through rehab. I had to humble myself. And I had to come to the conclusion that my plan stinketh much. And the committee in my head is a murderous committee. They all have my voice and they all want me dead. But they don't want me dead quickly. They want me to suffer. They want me to be homeless and cold and hungry and lonely and spiritless and godless and friendless and helpless. That's what that committee in my head wants for me. And so when I turn my will and my life over to the care of God, as I understand it, it is a process. It's higher than that. And part of my process is to be in service to other people. The third step prayer, I ask for that. And I make an appeal to God. I don't make a declarative statement. I don't stand there and say with my feet on the floor, may I do my will always. Oh, no, no. It's not a declarative statement. At the end of the third step prayer, I'm making an appeal and asking Him by His way of life, by His love, by His glory, love, and way of life. May I do His will always? I'm asking if He will get me out of the way. And in my head, this is the way that I envision, everything is visual for me. So when I get out of God's way, I'm on my knees. I duck so He can move forward because with me in the way, He doesn't have much room to move. I cast a pretty big shadow in my life. And I have a pretty big presence in regard to the people that I played with and the people that I worked with and the people that I lived with and my circle of friends. I'm a member of the fellowship of the trailer park where I live and the church that I go to attend, the AA groups that I attend, the musicians that I played with. So there were several fellowships that I'm a part of, and I'm no small member. But I want to be small with regard to God's will in my life. I want to be reflective of His influence for Him, for being by God in Him, and my higher power in Him. And so I want to be reflective. I want to personify and I want to exemplify His will for me in my life. And I want to be a good example to the other. And I tell you, sometimes it's a real challenge, particularly around the holidays. I'm not a great fan of Christmas. It was always a stressful time for me. But we're through it, and we're heading into the new year, and I'm ever so hopeful and optimistic, and more optimistic about the fellowship around me. Because when I see the work that God does in people's lives around me, when I see the spiritual changes or the spiritual maturity that come with two people in my life that I've known for a while, here's the magic of it. We see it in others before they see it themselves. I see the spiritual growth in David and Stephen and these people before they see it themselves. And that's one of the wonderful things about being a member of this program. I get to grow emotionally. I get to grow spiritually. I get to grow financially. That doesn't mean that I'm going to be rich. It just means that I won't fear being poor. And I'll be able to handle it. Because it isn't, I'm not at anyone else. I'm not able to. At any rate, I'm going to pull up with, I love you guys. I'm grateful to be here. And what the hell? I'm alive. And again, thanks for your share, Bill. Again, what I heard is being in for the long haul. This is not an overnight process, but I'm a full-term. My name's Matt, and I'm an alcoholic.
Thank you, Matt. And I think we got time for one more, I think. I'd like to call on the other Dave. I've heard Dave at the Monday night. Would you like to share a little bit?
Hey, Dave, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Dave.
Hey, thanks, Bill. Some of the stuff out with me in your story, you've been in AA, going to meetings and programs and stuff since 2016, and something I heard a lot was keep coming back. Something I got out of joining meetings was somebody told me one time was you're always going to get something out of a meeting, a message. You're always going to hear something that you need to hear. You just got to listen. My first couple years, I guess I wasn't listening at all. Something I ever heard was keep coming back. And that's what I needed to hear. That was the message that God was trying to show me, was trying to get me to listen to, was to keep coming back. I got pretty frustrated and agitated, and I quit quite a few times because I felt like that's all I was hearing, and I wasn't getting the message, you know, and then I finally realized, you know, God was telling me the message all the time, and to keep coming back. I've learned this time that I live a day by day program. It's definitely a day, like I said, a daily something I do every day, stay sober. You know, my morning meditation, my going to mind, my being in service and meetings, staying connected with my higher power, that spiritual connection, you know, that God consciousness. It says in the book, you know, I have to have those things to continue on down the sober path. You know, but as myself personally, I live day by day. I don't have too much more time than, you know, today, but I know I have today. And, being on with my spiritual connection, my morning meditation, and working on my have a good chance of making it tomorrow. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave. Well, during the time, man, you just got to do something for your sobriety every day. Every day you got to do something. I think without cutting into Bill's business meeting time, I sorry I didn't get to call on more people. I'd like to hear from everybody tonight, but you guys keep coming back and finish this eventually. And thanks to everybody again for listening to me. And like Kay said, just got to keep coming back, man. You know, and a little bit at a time, it'll get better. And thanks again, Bill, for asking.
Well, man, thanks.